Perhaps they knew they were being tracked, and everyone thought, if nothing else, it was good training for the fighters. If this were truly a war, all the participants told themselves, then it was becoming more and more real.
I don't buy it, the colonel said.
Sir, it looks to me like they were tracking you. They were sweeping you at double the rate that I can explain by the rotation of their dome. Their radar is completely electronic. They can steer their beams, and they were steering their beams. The sergeant's voice was reasonable and respectful, even though the officer who'd led the first probe was showing a little too much pride and not quite enough willingness to listen. He'd heard a little of what he was just told, but now he just shrugged it off.
Okay, maybe they did get a few hits. We were broadside aspect to them. Next time we'll deploy the patrol line farther out and do a directional penetration. That cuts our RCS by quite a bit. We have to tickle their line to see how they react.
Better you than me, pal, the sergeant thought. He looked out the window. Elmendorf Air Force Base was in Alaska and subject to dreadful winter weather, the worst enemy of any man-made machine. As a result, the B-1s were all in hangars which hid them from the satellite that Japan might or might not have operating. Still, nobody was sure about that.
Colonel, I'm just a sergeant who diddles with O-scopes, but I'd be careful about that. I don't know enough about this radar to tell you for sure how good it is. My gut tells me it's pretty damn good.
We'll be careful, the colonel promised. Tomorrow night we'll have a better set of tapes for you.
Roger that, sir.
Better you than me, pal, he thought again.
USS Pasadena had joined the north end of the patrol line west of Midway. It was possible for the submarines to report in with their satellite radios without revealing their positions except to PacFleet subops.
Not much of a line, Jones observed, looking at the chart. He had just come over to confer on what Sosa's had on Japanese naval movements, which was, at the moment, not much.
The best news available was that Sosa's, even with Jones' improved tracking software, wasn't getting anything on the line of Olympia, Helena, Honolulu, Chicago, and now Pasadena.
We used to have more boats than that just to cover the gap.
That's all the SSNs we have available, Ron, Chambers replied. And, yeah, it ain't much, but if they forward deploy their diesel boats, they'd better be real careful. Washington had given them that much by way of orders. An eastward move of Japanese warships would not be tolerated, and the elimination of one of their submarines would be approved, probably. It was just that the boat holding the contact had to call it in first for political approval. Mancuso and Chambers hadn't told Jones that. There was little sense in dealing with his temper again.
We have a bunch of SSNs in storage.
17 on the West Coast, to be exact, Chambers said. Minimum 6 months to reactivate them, not counting getting the crews spun up. Mancuso looked up.
Wait a minute. What about my 726s?
Jones turned.
I thought they were deactivated.
Subpac shook his head. The environmental people wouldn't let me. They all have caretaker crews aboard.
All five of them, Chambers said quietly. Nevada, Tennessee, West Virginia, Pennsylvania, and Maryland.
That's worth calling Washington about, sir.
Oh, yeah, Jones agreed.
The 726 class, more commonly known by the name of the lead ship, Ohio, which was now high-quality razor blades, was far slower than the smaller 688 class of fast attack boats, a lot less maneuverable and 10 knots slower, but they were also quiet. More than that, they defined what quiet was.
Wally, think we could scratch up crews for them?
I don't see why not, Admiral. We could have them moving in a week, 10 days max, if we can get the right people.
Well, that's something I can do.
Mancuso lifted the phone for Washington. The business day started in Central Europe at 10 o'clock local time, which was 9 o'clock in London and a dark 4 o'clock in New York. That made it 6 in the evening in Tokyo after what had been at first an exciting week, then a dull one,
which had allowed people to contemplate their brilliance at the killing they had made. Currency traders in the Japanese capital were surprised when things started quite normally. Markets came up online much as a business might open its doors for customers waiting outside for a long-awaited sale. It had been announced that it would happen that way. It was just that nobody here had really believed it. As one man, they phoned their supervisors for instructions, surprising them with the news from Berlin and the other European centers. At the New York FBI office, machines wired into the international trading network showed exactly the same display as those on every other continent. The Fed chairman and Secretary Fiedler watched. Both men had phones to their ears linked into an encrypted conference line with their European counterparts. The Bundesbank made the first move, trading 500 billion yen for the current equivalent in dollars to the Bank of Hong Kong, a very cautious transaction to test the waters. Hong Kong handled it as a matter of course, seeing a marginal advantage in the German mistake. The Bundesbank was foolish enough to expect that the reopening of the New York equities markets would bolster the dollar. The transaction was executed, Fiedler saw. He turned to the Fed chairman and winked. The next move was by the Swiss, and this one was a trillion yen for Hong Kong's remaining holding in U.S. treasuries. That transaction, too, went through the wires in less than a minute. The next one was more direct. The Bern Commercial Bank took Swiss francs back from a Japanese bank, trading yen holdings for them, another dubious move occasioned by a phone call from the Swiss government. The opening of European stock markets saw other moves. Banks and other institutions that made a strategic move to buy up Japanese equities as a counterbalance to Japanese acquisitions in European markets now started selling them off, immediately converting the yen holdings to other currencies. That was when the first alarm light went on in Tokyo. The Europeans' actions might have appeared to be mere profit-taking, but the currency conversions bespoke a belief that the yen was going to fall and fall hard, and it was a Friday night in Tokyo, and their trading floors were closed except for the currency traders and others working the European markets. They should be getting nervous now, Fiedler observed. I would, Jean-Jacques said in Paris. What nobody quite wanted to say was that the First World Economic War had just begun in earnest. There was an excitement to it, even though it ran contrary to all their instincts and experience. You know, I don't have a model to predict this, Gant said, 20 feet away from the two government officials. The European action, helpful as it was, confounded all computer models and preconceptions. Well, Pilgrim, that's why we've got brains and guts, George Winston responded deadpan. But what are our markets going to do? Winston grinned. Sure as hell we're going to find out in, about 7.5 hours. And you don't even have to shell out for the e-ticket. Where's your sense of adventure? I'm glad somebody's happy about this. There were worldwide rules for currency trading. Trading stopped once a currency had fallen a certain amount, but not this time. The floor under the yen was yanked out by every European government. Trading didn't stop, and the yen resumed its fall. They can't do that, someone said in Tokyo. But they were doing it, and he reached for a phone, knowing even then what his instructions would be. The yen was being attacked. They had to defend it, and the only way was to trade the foreign currency holdings they already owned in order to bring the yen holdings back home and out of the playing field of international speculation. Worst of all, there was no reason for this action. The yen was strong, especially against the American dollar. Soon it would replace it as the world's benchmark currency, especially if the American financial markets were foolish enough to reopen later in the day. The Europeans were making a sucker bet of such magnitude as to defy qualification, and since it didn't make sense, all the Japanese traders could do was to apply their own experience to the situation and act accordingly. The irony of the moment would have been delicious had they been able to appreciate it. Their actions were virtually automatic. Francs, French and Swiss, British pounds, German D-marks, Dutch guilders, and Danish kroner were dispersed in vast quantities to purchase yen, whose relative value everyone in Tokyo was sure could only appreciate, especially if the Europeans pegged their currencies to the dollar. There was an element of nervousness to it, but they did it, acting on the orders of their superiors, who were even now leaving their homes and catching cars or trains to the various commercial office buildings in which world trading was conducted. Equities were traded off in Europe as well, with the local currencies converted to yen. The expectation, again, was that when the American collapse resumed, the European currencies would fall, and with them the values of stock issues. Then Japan could reacquire even larger quantities of European stocks. The European moves were a sad case of misplaced loyalty or confidence, or something, the people in Tokyo thought. But sad or not, it worked in their favor, and that was just fine. By noon London time, a massive movement had taken place. Individual investors and smaller institutions, seeing what everyone else had done, had moved in, foolishly, the Japanese knew. Noon London time was 7 a.m. on America's East Coast. "My fellow Americans," President Durling said at exactly 7:05 a.m. on every TV network. "On Wednesday night, I told you that today American financial markets are going to reopen." "Here it goes," Kozo Matsuda said, just back in his office and watching CNN. "He's going to say that they can't and Europe is going to panic." "Splendid," he told his aides, turning back to the TV. The American president was smiling and confident. Well, a politician had to know how to act, the better to lie to his citizens. The problems which the market experienced last week came from a deliberate assault on the American economy. "Nothing like this has ever happened before, and I'm going to walk you through what happened, how it was done, and why it was done. We've spent an entire week accumulating this information, and even now Treasury Secretary Fiedler and the Chairman of the Federal Reserve Board are in New York, working with the heads of the great American financial institutions to set things aright. I am also pleased to report that we've had the time to consult with our friends in Europe, and that our historic allies have chosen to stand with us as faithfully in this time of difficulty as they have in other times. So, what really happened last Friday?" Roger Durling asked. Matsuda set his drink down on his desk when he saw the first chart appear on the screen. Jack watched him go through it. The trick, as always, was to make a complex story simple, and that task had involved two professors of economics, half of Fiedler's personal staff, and a governor of the Securities and Exchange Commission, all working in coordination with the president's best speechwriter. Even so, it took 25 minutes, 6 flip charts, and would require a number of government spokesmen talking who were even now on background to reporters whose briefings had started at 6:30. "I told you Wednesday night that nothing of consequence had happened to us. Not one piece of property has been affected. Not one farm has lost anything. Each of you is the same person you were a week ago, with the same abilities, the same home, the same job, the same family and friends. What happened last Friday was an attack not on our country itself, but on our national confidence. Our confidence is a harder and tougher target than people realize, and that is something we're going to prove today." Most of the people in the trading business were en route to their offices and missed the speech, but their employers had all taped it, and there were also printed copies on every desk and at every computer terminal. The trading day would not start until noon, moreover, and there were strategy sessions to be held everywhere, though nobody really had much idea of what to do. The most obvious response to the situation was indeed so obvious that no one knew whether or not to try it. "They are doing it to us," Matsuda said, watching his screens. "What can we do to stop it?" "It depends on what their stock market does," his senior technical trader replied, not knowing what else to say and not knowing what to expect either.
"Do you think it'll work, Jack?" Durling asked.
He had two speeches sitting in folders on his desk and didn't know which he would be giving in the evening. The National Security Advisor shrugged.
Don't know. It gives them a way out. Whether or not they make use of it is up to them.
So now we just get to sit and wait.
That's about it, Mr. President.
The second session was held in the State Department. Secretary Hansen huddled with Scott Adler, who then met with his negotiating team and waited. The Japanese delegation arrived at 9:45.
Good morning, Adler said pleasantly.
A pleasure to see you again, the ambassador replied, taking his hand, but not as confidently as on the day before.
Not surprisingly, he had not had time to receive detailed instructions from Tokyo.
Adler had halfway expected a request for a postponement of the session, but no, that would have been too obvious a sign of weakness. And so the ambassador, a skilled and experienced diplomat, was in the most precarious of diplomatic positions. He was forced to represent his government with nothing more to fall back on than his wits and his knowledge. Adler walked him to his seat, then returned to his side of the table. Since America was the host today, Japan got to speak first. Adler had placed a side bet with the secretary as to the ambassador's opening statement.
First of all, it needs to be said that my government objects in the strongest terms to the attack on our currency engineered by the United States.
That's $10 you owe me, Mr. Secretary, Adler thought, behind an impassive face.
Mr. Ambassador, he replied, that is something we could say just as easily. In fact, here is the data which we have developed on the events of last week.
Binders appeared on the table and were slid across to the Japanese diplomats.
I need to tell you that we are now conducting an investigation that could well lead to the indictment of Raizo Yamata for wire and securities fraud.
It was a bold play for a number of reasons. It showed everything that the Americans knew about the attack on Wall Street and pointed to the things yet to be learned. As such, it could have no effect other than to ruin the criminal case against Yamata and his allies, should it come to that. But that was a side issue. Adler had a war to stop, and stop quickly. He'd let the boys and girls at Justice worry about the other stuff.
It might be better, of course, for your country to deal with this man and his acts, Adler offered next, giving generous maneuvering room to the ambassador and his government. The net effect of his actions, as may be seen today, will be to cause greater hardship to your country than to ours. Now, if we may, I should like us to return to the issue of the Mariana Islands.
The 1-2 punch predictably staggered the Japanese delegation. As was often the case, nearly everything was left unsaid. We know what you did. We know how you did it. We are prepared to deal with all of it. The brutally direct method was designed to conceal the real American problem, the inability to make an immediate military counter, but it also provided Japan with the ability to separate her government from the acts of certain of her citizens, and that, Ryan and Adler had decided the previous night, was the best means of achieving a quick and clean end to the situation. To that end, a large carrot was required.
The United States seeks little more than a return to normal relations. The immediate evacuation of the Marianas will allow us to consider a more lenient interpretation of the Trade Reform Act. This also is something we are willing to place on the table for consideration. It was probably a mistake to hit him with this much, Adler thought, but the alternative was further bloodshed. By the end of the first session of formal negotiations, something remarkable had happened. Neither side had repeated a position. Rather, it had been, in diplomatic terms, a free-form exchange of views, few of them well considered.
Chris, Adler whispered when he stood, find out what they're really thinking.
Got it, Cook replied.
He got himself some coffee and headed out to the terrace where Nagumo stood on the edge, looking out toward the Lincoln Memorial.
It's an elegant way out, C.G., Cook offered. You push us too hard, Nagumo said without turning. If you want a chance to end this without getting people killed, this is the best one.
The best for you, perhaps. What of our interests?
We'll cut a deal on trade.
Cook didn't understand it all. Unschooled in financial matters, he was as yet unaware of what was happening on that front. To him, the recovery of the dollar and the protection of the American economy was an isolated act. Nagumo knew different. The attack his country had begun could be balanced only by a counterattack. The effect would not be restoration of the status quo ante, but rather serious damage to his own country's economy on top of pre-existing damage from the Trade Reform Act. In this, Nagumo knew something that Cook did not. Unless America acceded to Japanese demands for some territorial gain, then the war was quite real.
We need time, Christopher.
Seiji, there isn't time. Look, the media haven't picked up on this yet. That can change at any moment. If the public finds out, there's going to be hell to pay.
Because Cook was right, he'd given Nagumo an opening.
Yes, there may well be, Chris, but I am protected by my diplomatic status, and you are not.
He didn't need to say more than that.
Now wait a minute, Seiji. My country needs more than what you offer, Nagumo replied coldly. We're giving you a way out. We must have more.
There was no turning back now, was there?
Nagumo wondered if the ambassador knew that yet. Probably not, he judged, from the way the senior diplomat was looking in his direction. It was suddenly clear to him. Yamata and his allies had committed his country to action from which there was no backing away, and he couldn't decide if they'd known it or not when they'd begun. But that didn't matter now.
We must have something, he went on, to show for our actions.
And about that time, Cook realized how slow he'd been on the uptake. Looking in Nagumo's eyes, he saw it all. Not so much cruelty as resolve. The Deputy Assistant Secretary of State thought about the money sitting in a numbered account, and the questions that would be asked, and what possible explanation he might have for it. It sounded like an old-fashioned school bell when the digital clock turned from 11:59:59 to 12 noon.
Thank you, H.G. Wells, a trader breathed, standing on the wooden floor of the New York Stock Exchange. The time machine was in operation. For the first time in his memory, at this hour of the day, the floor was clean. Not a single paper slip lay there. The various traders at their kiosks looked around and saw some signs of normality. The ticker had been running for half an hour, showing the same data it had displayed the previous week, really as a way of synchronizing their minds with the new day, and everyone used it as a touchstone, a personal contact with reality that both was and was not. It was a hell of a speech the president had given 5 hours earlier. Everyone on the floor had seen it at least once, most of them right here, followed by a pep talk from the head of the NYSE that would have done Newt Rockne proud. They had a mission that day, a mission that was more important than their individual well-being, and one that, if accomplished, would see to their long-term security as well as that of the entire country. They had spent the day reconstructing their activities of the previous Friday, to the point where every trader knew what quantities of which stock he or she held, what every position was. Some even remembered the moves they'd been planning to make, but most of those had been up moves rather than down ones, and their collective memory would not allow them to follow through on them. On the other hand, they remembered well the panic of the afternoon 7 days before, and knowing that it had been both artificial and malicious, no one wished to start it afresh. And besides, Europe had signaled its confidence in the dollar in the strongest terms. The bond market was as solidly fixed as though set in granite, and the first moves of the day had been to buy U.S. treasuries to take advantage of the stunning deal offered by the Fed chairman. That move was the best confidence builder they'd ever seen. For over 90 seconds by one trader's watch, exactly nothing happened on the floor of the exchange. The ticker simply displayed nothing. The phenomenon evoked snorts of disbelief from men whose minds raced to understand it. The little guy investors, without a clue, were making few calls, and those who did were told by their brokers to sit tight.
and for the most part that was what they did. Those who did make sale orders had them handled in-house by their brokerage houses from the reservoir of issues that they had on hand, left over from the previous week. But the big traders weren't doing anything either. Each of them was waiting for somebody else to do something. The inactivity of merely a minute and a half seemed an eternity to people accustomed to frantic action, and when the first major play happened, it came as a relief. The first big move of the day, predictably, came from the Columbus Group. It was a massive purchase of Citibank Common. Seconds later, Merrill Lynch pushed the button for a similar acquisition of Chemical Bank. "Yeah," a few voices said on the floor. It made sense, didn't it? Citibank was vulnerable to a fall in the dollar, but the Europeans had seen to it that the dollar was rising in value, and that made First National Citibank a good issue to pick up on. As a result, the first tick of the Dow Jones Industrial Average was up, defying every prediction of every computer. "Yeah, we can do this," another floor trader observed. "I want 100 Manihani at 6," he announced. That would be the next bank to benefit from the increasing strength of the dollar, and he wanted a supply that he could move out at 6.25. The stocks that had led the slide the previous week would now lead a rise, and for the same reasons as before. Mad as it sounded, it made perfect sense, they all realized, and as soon as the rest of the market figured it out, they could all cash in on it. The news ticker on the wall was up and running, again giving shorthand selections off the wire services. GM, it said, was rehiring 20,000 workers for its plants around Detroit in anticipation of increased auto sales. The callback would take 9 months, the announcement didn't say, and was the result of a call from the Secretaries of Commerce and Labor, but it was enough to excite interest in auto stocks, and that excited interest in machine tools. By 12:05:30, the Dow was up 5 points, hardly a hiccup after the 500-point plummet 7 days before, but it looked like Everest on a clear day from the floor of the NYSE. "I don't believe this," Mark Gant observed several blocks away in the Javits Federal Office Building. "Where the hell is it written down that computers are always right?" George Winston inquired with another forced grin. He had his own worries. Buying up Citibank was not without dangers, but his move, he saw, had the proper effect on the issue. When it had moved up 3 points, he initiated a slow sell-off to cash in, as other fund managers moved in to follow the trend. Well, that was predictable, wasn't it? The herd just needed a leader. Show them a trend and wait for them to follow, and if it was contrarian, so much the better. "First impression, it's working," the Fed chairman told his European colleagues. All the theories said it should, but theories seemed thin at moments like this. Both he and Secretary Fiedler were watching Winston, now leaning back in his chair, chewing on a pen, and talking calmly into a phone. They could hear what he was saying. At least his voice was calm, though his body was that of a man in a fight, every muscle tense. But after another 5 minutes, they saw him stretch tense muscles and smile and turn and say something to Gant, who merely shook his head in wonderment as he watched his computer screen do things that it didn't believe possible. "Well, how about that?" Ryan said.
"Is it good?" President Durling asked.
"Let's put it this way. If I were you, I'd give your speechwriter a dozen long-stemmed red roses and tell her to plan on working here another 4 years or so."
"It's way too early for that, Jack," the president replied, somewhat crossly.
Ryan nodded. "Yes, sir, I know. What I mean to tell you is you did it. The markets may, hell, will fluctuate the rest of the day, but they're not going to freefall like we initially expected. It's about confidence, boss. You restored it, and that's a fact."
"And the rest of it?"
"They've got a chance to back down. We'll know by the end of the day."
"And if they don't?"
The National Security Advisor thought about that. "Then we have to figure a way to fight them without hurting them too badly. We have to find their nukes, and we have to settle this thing down before it really gets out of control."
"Is that possible?"
Ryan pointed to the screen.
"We didn't think this was possible, did we?"
Chapter 35. Consequences.
It happened in Idaho, in a community outside Mountain Home Air Force Base. A staff sergeant based there had flown out to Anderson Air Force Base on Guam to work on the approach control radars. His wife had delivered a baby a week after his departure, and she attempted to call him that evening to tell him about his new daughter, only to learn that the phones were out due to a storm. Only 20 years old and not well educated, she'd accepted the news with disappointment. The military comm links were busy, an officer had told her, convincingly enough, that she'd gone home with tears in her eyes. A day later, she talked to her mother and surprised her with the news that her husband didn't know about his daughter yet. Even in time of war, her mother thought, such news always got through, and what storm could possibly be worse than fighting a war? So she called the local TV station and asked for the weatherman, a sagacious man of 50, who was excellent at predicting the tornadoes that churned through the region every spring, and, it was widely thought, saved 5 or 10 lives each year with his instant analysis of which way the funnel clouds moved. The weatherman, in turn, was the kind who enjoyed being stopped in the local supermarkets with friendly comments, and took the inquiry as yet another compliment for his professional expertise. And besides, he'd never checked out the Pacific Ocean before, but it was easy enough. He linked into the NOAA satellite system and used a computer to go backwards in time to see what sort of storm had hammered those islands. The time of year was wrong for a typhoon, he knew, but it was the middle of an ocean, and storms happened there all the time. But not this year, and not this time. The satellite photos showed a few wispy clouds, but otherwise fair weather. For a few minutes, he wondered if the Pacific Ocean, like Arkansas, was subject to fair-weather gales. But no, that wasn't likely, since those adiabatic storms resulted mainly from variations in temperature and land elevation, whereas an ocean was both flat and moderate. He checked with a colleague who'd been a Navy meteorologist to confirm it, and found himself left only with a mystery. Thinking that perhaps the information he had was wrong, he consulted his telephone book and dialed 011-671-555-1212, since a directory assistance call was toll-free. He got a recording that told him that there had been a storm, except there had not been a storm. Was he the first guy to figure that out? His next move was to walk across the office to the news department. Within minutes, an inquiry went out on one of the wire services.
Ryan.
Bob Holtzman, Jack, I have a question for you. I hope it's not about Wall Street, Jack replied in as unguarded a voice as he could muster.
No, it's about Guam. Why are the phone lines out?
Bob, did you ask the phone company that? Ryan tried.
Yeah, they say there was a storm that took a lot of lines down, except for a couple of things. One, there wasn't any storm. Two, there's an undersea cable and a satellite link. Three, a week is a long time.
What's going on? The reporter asked.
How many people are asking?
Right now, just me and a TV station in Little Rock that put a request up on the AP wire. Another 30 minutes and it's going to be a lot more.
What gives?
Some sort of... Bob, why don't you come on down here, Ryan suggested.
Well, it's not as though you expected this to last forever, Jack told himself. Then he called Scott Adler's office. But why couldn't it have waited one more day?
Yukon was fueling her second set of ships. The urgency of the moment meant that the fleet oiler was taking on 2 escorts at a time, one on either beam, while her helicopter transferred various parts and other supplies around the formation, about half of them aircraft components, to restore Ike's aircraft to full mission status. The sun would set in another 30 minutes, and the underway replenishment operations would continue under cover of darkness. Nubro's battle force had darted east, the better to distance itself from the Indian formation, and again had gone to MCON with all radars off and a deceptive placement of their surveillance aircraft. But they lost track of the 2 Indian carriers, and while the Hawkeyes probed cautiously, Dubrow sweated.
Lookouts report unknown aircraft inbound at 215, a talker called.
The admiral swore quietly, lifted his binoculars, and turned to the southwest.
there. Two Sea Harriers, playing it smart, too, he saw. They were at 5,000 feet or so, tucked into the neat two-plane element used for tactical combat and air shows, flying straight and level, careful not to overfly any ship directly. Before they had passed over the first ring of escorts, a pair of Tomcats were above and behind them, ready to take them out in a matter of seconds if they showed hostile intent. But hostile intent meant loosing a weapon first, and in this day and age, a loosed weapon most probably meant a hit, whatever happened to the launch aircraft. The Harriers flew overhead one time only. They seemed to be carrying extra fuel tanks and maybe a reconnaissance pod, but no weapons, this time. Admiral Chandrasekhar was no fool, but then Dubrow had never made that assumption. His adversary had played a patient game, sticking to his own mission and biding his time, and learning from every trick the Americans had shown him. None of this was of much comfort to the Battle Force commander. "Follow them back?" Commander Harrison asked dispassionately. Mike Dubrow shook his head. "Pull one of the Hummers in close and track by radar." When the hell would Washington realize he had an imminent confrontation brewing? "Mr. Ambassador," Scott Adler said, folding up the note an aide had just delivered, "it is likely that in the next 24 hours your occupation of the Marianas will become public knowledge. At that point, the situation will go beyond our control. You have plenipotentiary powers to resolve this affair." But he didn't, as Adler had begun to suspect, despite assurances to the contrary. He could also see that he'd pushed the man too hard and too fast, not that he'd had a choice in the matter. The entire affair had been going on for barely a week. In normal diplomatic practice, it took that long just to select the kind of chairs the negotiators sat in. In that respect, everything had been doomed from the beginning, but Adler was a professional diplomat for whom hope was never dead. Even now, as he concluded his latest statement, he looked into the man's eyes for something he'd be able to report to the White House. "Throughout our talks, we have heard about America's demands, but we have not heard a single word concerning my country's legitimate security interests. Today, you have conducted a systematic attack on our financial and economic foundations, and..." Adler leaned forward. "Mr. Ambassador, a week ago, your country did the same thing to us as the information in front of you demonstrates. A week ago, your country conducted an attack on the United States Navy. A week ago, your country seized U.S. territory. In equity, sir, you have no place to criticize us for efforts necessary to the restoration of our own economic stability." He paused for a moment, reproving himself for the decidedly undiplomatic language of his outburst, but events had gone beyond such niceties, or they soon would. "We have offered you the opportunity to negotiate in good faith for a mutually acceptable interpretation of the Trade Reform Act. We will accept an apology and reparations for the losses to our Navy. We require the immediate evacuation of Japanese military forces from the Mariana Islands." But things had already gone too far for that, and everyone at the table knew it. There just wasn't time. Adler felt the dreadful weight of inevitability. All his skills were useless now. Other events and other people had taken matters out of his hands, and the ambassador's hands as well. He saw the same look on the man's face that must have been on his own. His voice was mechanical. "Before I can respond to that, I must consult with my government. I propose that we adjourn so that consultations may be carried out." Adler nodded more with sadness than anger. "As you wish, Mr. Ambassador. If you should need us, we will be available."
"My God, you kept all that quiet? How?" Holtzman demanded.
"Because you guys were all looking the other way," Jack answered bluntly. "You've always depended too much on us for information anyway." He instantly regretted those words. It had come out as too much of a challenge.
"Stress, Jack."
"But you lied to us about the carriers, and you never told us about the submarines at all."
"We're trying to stop this thing before it gets worse," President Durling said. "We're talking to them over at State right now."
"You've had a busy week," the journalist acknowledged.
Guilty's out? The president nodded. He's talking with the Justice Department and with the victims. The big thing was getting the markets put back in place, Ryan said. That was the real...
What do you mean they've killed people? Holtzman objected.
Bob, why have you guys been hammering the Wall Street story so hard all week? Damn it, what was really scary about their attack on us was the way they wrecked the financial markets and did their run on the dollar. We had to fix that first. Bob Holtzman conceded the point. How the hell did you pull that one off?
God, who would have thunk it? Mark Gant asked.
The bell had rung to close the abbreviated trading day. The Dow was down 4.25 points with 400 million shares traded. The S&P 500 was actually up a fraction, as was NASDAQ, because the blue-chip companies had suffered more from general nerves than the smaller fry. But the bond market was the best of all, and the dollar was solid. The Japanese yen, on the other hand, had taken a fearful beating against every Western currency.
The changes in bonds will drop the stock market next week, Winston said, rubbing his face and thanking Providence for his luck. Residual nerves in the market would encourage people to seek out safer places for their money, though the strength of the dollar would swiftly ameliorate that.
By the end of the week? Gant wondered.
Maybe. I'm not so sure. A lot of manufacturing stocks are still undervalued.
Your move on Citibank was brilliant, the Fed chairman said, taking a place next to the traders.
They didn't deserve the hit they took last week, and everyone knew it. I was just the first to make the purchase, Winston replied matter-of-factly.
Besides, we came out ahead on the deal.
He tried not to be too smug about it.
It had just been another exercise in psychology. He'd done something both logical and unexpected to initiate a brief trend, then cashed in on it. Business as usual.
Any idea how Columbus made out today? Secretary Fiedler asked.
Up about 10, Gant replied at once, meaning $10 million, a fair day's work under the circumstances.
We'll do better next week.
An FBI agent came over.
Call in from DTC. They're posting everything normally. That part of the system seems to be back to normal.
What about Chuck Searles? Winston asked.
Well, we've taken his apartment completely apart. He had two brochures about New Caledonia, of all places. That's part of France, and we have the French looking for him.
Want some good advice?
Mr. Winston, we always look for advice, the agent replied with a grin.
The mood in the room was contagious.
Look in other directions, too.
We're checking everything.
Yeah, Buzz, the president said, lifting the phone. Ryan, Holtzman, and two Secret Service agents saw Jumper close his eyes and let out a long breath. He'd been getting reports from Wall Street all afternoon, but it wasn't official for him until he heard it from Secretary Fiedler.
Thanks, my friend. Please let everybody know that I...
Good. Thanks. See you tonight.
Derling replaced the phone.
Jack, you are a good man in a storm.
One storm left.
So does that end it? Holtzman asked, not really understanding what Derling had said.
Ryan took the answer.
We don't know yet.
But the incident with the carriers can be written off as an accident, and we won't know for sure what happened to the submarines until we look at the hulls. They're in 15,000 feet of water, Jack told him, cringing inwardly for saying such things. But this was war, and war was something you tried to avoid, if possible, he reminded himself.
There's the chance that we can both back away from this, write it off to a misunderstanding, a few people acting without authority, and if they get hammered for it, nobody else dies.
And you're telling me all this?
It traps you, doesn't it? Jack asked.
If the talks over at State work out, then you have a choice, Bob. You can either help us keep things quiet, or you can have a shooting war on your conscience.
Welcome to the club, Mr. Holtzman.
Look, Ryan, I can't...
Sure you can.
You've done it before.
Jack noted that the president sat there and listened, saying nothing.
That was partly to distance himself from Ryan's maneuvering, but another part perhaps liked what he saw, and Holtzman was playing along.
So what does all this mean?
Goto asked.
It means that they will bluster,
Yamata told him. It means that our country needs leadership, he couldn't say. They cannot take the islands back. They lack the resources to attack us. They may have patched up their financial markets for now, but Europe and America cannot survive without us indefinitely, and by the time they realize that, we will not need them as we do now. Don't you see? This has always been about independence for us. When we achieve that, everything will change. And for now, nothing changes. The new American trade laws would have the same effect as hostilities. At least, this way we get something for it and we will have the chance of ruling our own house. That's what it really came down to, the one thing that nobody but he ever quite saw. His country could make products and sell them, but so long as his country needed markets more than the markets needed his country, trade laws could cripple Japan, and his country would have no recourse at all. Always the Americans. It was always them, forcing an early end to the Russo-Japanese War, denying their imperial ambitions, allowing them to build up their economy, then cutting the legs out from under them, 3 times now. The same people who'd killed his family. Didn't they see? Now Japan had struck back, and timidity still prevented people from seeing reality. It was all Yamata could manage to rein in his anger at this small and foolish man. But he needed Goto, even though the Prime Minister was too stupid to realize that there was no going back.
You're sure that they cannot respond to our actions?
Goto asked after a minute or so of contemplation.
Hiroshi, it is as I have been telling you for months. We cannot fail to win, unless we fail to try.
Damn, I wish we could use these things to do our surveys. The real magic of overhead imagery lay not in individual photographs, but rather in pairs of photographs, generally taken a few seconds apart from the same camera, then transmitted down to the ground stations at Sunnyvale and Fort Belvoir. Real-time viewing was all well and good to excite the imagination of congressmen privy to such things, or to count items in a hurry. For real work, you used prints set in pairs and viewed through a stereoscope, which worked better than the human eyes for giving precise three-dimensionality to the photos. It was almost as good as flying over in a helicopter. Maybe even better, the Amtrak official thought, because you could go backwards as well as forwards.
The satellites cost a lot of money, Betsy Fleming observed.
Yeah, like our whole budget for a year. This one's interesting. A team of professional photo interpretation experts was analyzing every frame, of course, but the plain truth of the matter was that CIA and NRO had stopped being interested in the technical aspects of railroad building decades ago. Tracking individual trains loaded with tanks or missiles was one thing. This was something else.
How so?
The Shinkansen line is a revenue maker. This spur isn't going to make much money for them. Maybe they can cut a tunnel up here, he went on, manipulating the photos. Maybe they can make it into that city. But me, I'd come the other way and save the money on engineering. Of course, it could just be a shunt to use for servicing the main line.
Huh?
He didn't even lift his eyes from the stereo viewer. A place to stash work cars, snowblowers, that sort of thing. It's well sited for that purpose, except there's no such cars there. The resolution of the photos was just fantastic. They'd been taken close to noon local time, and you could see the sun's glint on the rails of the main line and the spur as well. He figured that the width of the rails was about the resolution limit of the cameras, an interesting fact that he couldn't relay to anyone else. The ties were concrete like the rest of the bullet train line, and the quality of the engineering was, well, something he'd envied for a long time. The official looked up reluctantly.
No way it's a revenue line. The turns are all wrong. You couldn't do 30 miles per hour through there, and the train sets on that line cruise over 100.
Funny, though. It just disappears.
Oh? Betsy asked.
See for yourself. The executive stood to stretch, giving Mrs. Fleming a place at the viewer. He picked up a large-scale map of the valley and looked to see where things went.
You know, when Hill and Stevens built the Great Northern... Betty wasn't interested.
Chris, take a look at this.
Their visitor looked up from the map.
Oh, the truck? I don't know what color they paint there. Not green.
Time usually worked in favor of diplomacy, but not in this case, Adler thought as he entered the White House. He knew the way and had a Secret Service agent to conduct him in case he got lost. The Deputy Secretary of State was surprised to see a reporter in the Oval Office, even more so when he was allowed to stay. "You can talk," Ryan told him. Scott Adler took a deep breath and started his report. "They're not backing down on anything. The ambassador isn't very comfortable with the situation, and it shows. I don't think he's getting much by way of instructions out of Tokyo, and that worries me. Chris Cook thinks they're willing to let us have Guam back in a demilitarized condition, but they want to keep the rest of the islands. I dangled a TRA at them, but no substantive response." He paused before going on. "It's not going to work. We can keep at it for a week or a month, but it's just not going to happen. Fundamentally, they don't know what they're into. They see a continuum of engagement between the military and economic sides. They don't see the firebreak between the two. They don't see that they've crossed over a line, and they don't see the need to cross back." "You're saying there's a war happening?" Holtzman observed, to make things clear. It made him feel foolish to ask the question. He didn't notice the same aura of unreality surrounding everyone else in the room. Adler nodded. "I'm afraid so."
"So what are we going to do about it?"
"What do you suppose?" President Durling asked. Commander Dutch Claggett had never expected to be in this situation. A fast-track officer since his graduation from the U.S. Naval Academy 23 years earlier, his career had come to a screeching halt aboard USS Maine when, as executive officer, he'd been present for the only loss of an American fleet ballistic missile submarine. The irony was that his life's ambition had been command of a nuclear submarine. But command of Tennessee meant nothing at all now. It was just an entry on his first resume when he entered the civilian job market. Her designed mission was to carry Trident II sea-launched ballistic missiles, but the missiles were gone, and the only reason that she still existed at all was because the local environmental movement had protested her dismantlement to federal district court, and the judge, a lifelong member of the Sierra Club, had agreed to the arguments, which were again on their way back to the United States Court of Appeals. Claggett had been in command of Tennessee for 9 months now, but the only time he'd been underway had been to move from one side of the pier to another. Not exactly what he'd had in mind for his career. It could be worse, he told himself in the privacy of his cabin. He could have been dead, along with so many of the others from USS Maine. But Tennessee was still all his. He didn't even share her with a second CO, and he was still a naval officer in command of a man of war, technically speaking, and his reduced crew of 85 drilled every day because that was the life of the sea, even tied alongside a pier. His reactor plant, known to its operators as Tennessee Power and Light Company, was lit up at least once per week. The sonar men played acquisition and tracking games against audio tapes, and the rest of those aboard operated every shipboard system, down to tinkering with the single Mark 48 torpedo aboard. It had to be this way. The rest of the crew wasn't being served, after all, and it was his duty to them to maintain their professional standing should they get the transfers they all wanted to a submarine that actually went to sea.
"Message from Sub-Pack, sir,"
a yeoman said, handing over a clipboard. Claggett took the board and signed first for receipt. "Report, earliest date ready to put to sea."
"What the hell?" Commander Claggett asked the bulkhead.
Then he realized that the message ought to have come through group, at least, not straight from Pearl. He lifted his phone and dialed Sub-Pack from memory.
"Admiral Mancuso, please. Tennessee calling."
"Dutch, what's your materiel condition?" Bart Mancuso asked without preamble.
"Everything works, sir. We even had our oars 2 weeks ago, and we maxed it."
Claggett referred to the Operational Reactor Safeguards Examination, still the holy grail of the nuclear navy, even for razor blade fodder.
I know. How soon? Mancuso asked. The bluntness of the question was like something from the past.
I need to load food and torps, and I need 30 people.
Where are you weak?
Claggett thought for a moment. His officers were on the young side, but he didn't mind that, and he had a good collection of senior chiefs.
Nowhere, really. I'm working these people hard.
Okay, good, Dutch. I'm cutting orders to get you ready to sail ASAP. Group is getting into gear now. I want you to move just as fast as you can. Mission orders are on the way. Be prepared to stay at sea for 90 days.
Aye, aye, sir, Claggett heard the line go dead.
A moment later, he lifted his phone and called for his department heads and chiefs to meet in the wardroom.
The meeting had not yet started when the phone rang again. It was a call from Group asking for Claggett's precise manpower needs.
Your house has a fine view. Is it for sale?
Oreza shook his head.
No, it's not, he told the man at the door.
Perhaps you would think about it. You are a fisherman, yes?
Yes, sir, I am. I have a charter boat.
Yes, I know.
The man looked around, clearly admiring the size and location of what was really a fairly ordinary tract house by American standards. Manuel and Isabel Oreza had bought it 5 years earlier, just barely beating the real estate boom on Saipan.
I would pay much for this, the man said.
But then where would I live? Portugee asked.
Over $1 million, the man persisted.
Strangely enough, Oreza felt a flash of anger at the offer. He still had a mortgage, after all, and paid the bill every month. Actually, his wife did, but that was beside the point. The typical American monthly ritual of pulling the ticket out of the book, filling out the check, tucking both in the pre-printed envelope and dropping it in the mail on the first day of the month. The entire procedure was proof to them that they did indeed own their first house after 30-plus years of being government service tumbleweeds. The house was theirs.
Sir, this house is mine, okay? I live here. I like it here.
The man was as friendly and polite as he could be, in addition to being a pushy son of a bitch. He handed over a card.
I know. Please excuse my intrusion. I would like to hear from you after you have had a chance to consider my offer.
And with that, he walked to the next house in the development.
What the hell? Oreza whispered, closing the door.
What was that all about? Pete Burrows asked.
He wants to pay me $1 million for the house.
Nice view, Burrows observed. On the California coast, this would go for a nice price, but not that much. You wouldn't believe what Japanese real estate prices are.
$1 million?
And that was just his opening offer, Oreza reminded himself. The man had his Toyota Land Cruiser parked in the cul-de-sac and was clearly walking from one house to another, seeing what he could buy.
Oh, he'd turn it over for a lot more, or maybe, if he was smart, just rent it.
But then where would we live?
You wouldn't, Burroughs replied.
How much you want to bet they give you a first-class ticket stateside at the settlement?
Think about it, the engineer suggested.
Well, that's interesting, Robbie Jackson thought. Anything else happening?
The cans we saw before are gone now. Things are settling back down to... Hell, they are normal now, except for all the soldiers around.
Any trouble?
No, sir, nothing. Same food ships coming in, same tankers, same everything. Air traffic has slowed down a lot.
The soldiers sort of dug in, but they're being very careful how they do it.
Not much visible anymore.
There's still a lot of bush country on the island. I guess they're all hid in there. I ain't been going looking, you know, Jackson heard him say.
That's fine. Just stay cool, Master Chief. Good report. Let me get back to work.
Okay, Admiral. Jackson made his notes. He really should have turned this stuff over to somebody else, but Chief Oreza would want a familiar voice on the other end of the circuit, and everything was taped for the intelligence guys anyway. But he had other things to do, too. The Air Force would be running another probe of Japanese air defenses tonight. The SSN patrol line would move west another 100 miles, and people would gather a lot of intelligence information, mainly from satellites. Enterprise would make Pearl Harbor today.
There were two complete carrier air wings at Barbers Point Naval Air Station, but no carriers to put them on. The Army's 25th Infantry Division Light was still based at Schofield Barracks a few miles away, but there were no ships to put them on either. The same was true.